Roy Bookbinder plays Southern blues and hillbilly music. At the beginning of his career, he sought out the Reverend Gary Davis, who taught him about the blues and took him on tour for a couple of years. Bookbinder also went to the South to track down one of his favorite performers, Pink Anderson, who had played in medicine shows for over 40 years. Before Anderson died, he taught Bookbinder many of his songs. Bookbinder tours continually, living out of his Airstream motorhome. In addition to performing at festivals and state fairs, he's become a regular guest on the Nashville Network's cable TV show Nashville Now. He has an album about to be released on Rounder Records called Bookaroo. When Roy Bookbinder visited our studios, he brought his guitar, and he kicked off our interview with the song Black Dog Blues.
Call me a dog when I'm gone. It's old Black Dog when I'm gone. But when I get home with a $10 bill, is Daddy where you've been so long? Well, I've been all around Kentucky in the state of old Tennessee. Dog when I'm gone, Lord, Lord, old Black Dog when I'm gone. When I get home with a $10 bill, is Daddy where you've been so long? My daddy was a gambling man from the state of old Tennessee. He taught me to bet all of my money on ace, jack, that deuce, and a tray. Go pick it, Roy. Train, it's coming, carrying my baby away. It's going all far to leave me, ain't never coming back my way. And it's old Black Dog when I'm gone, Lord, Lord, it's old Black Dog when I'm gone. But when I get home with a $10 bill, Daddy, where you've been so long? Black Dog Blues.
Performed by my guest, Roy Bookbinder. You know, I know that you've been singing blues and country blues for many years, and once you were billed in a club as yet another white blues singer, what do you think of that kind of attitude that somehow it's not authentic for people from the North or for white people to be singing Southern-based blues?
Well, I think it's totally wrong, because there's a tradition of, quote, white blues singers throughout the history of country music and blues music. That song I just did, the Black Dog Blues, was originally recorded by a bunch of fellas, a black and white. It was recorded by Bayless Rose, who was a black guitar player and singer, and it was recorded by Dick Justice, both in about 1927. Back in the 20s, it was the record industry that decided that white singers were hillbillies and black singers were blues singers. And it didn't have a whole lot to do with what kind of music was played. It was just a classification: race music for the black race and hillbilly music for the white race. And I know a lot of black singers that were really hillbillies. They wanted to sing certain songs, and the record industry told them, oh, don't do that. We got that saved for so-and-so. And my friend Pink Anderson, his whole life, wanted to record My Blue Heaven, and nobody would let him.
Really? Because a black man shouldn't be performing Tin Pan Alley?
Well, it also had a lot to do with the publishing industry. They told the black man, if you come up with a, quote, original blues-type song, we'll give you $50. You want to do My Blue Heaven, you're not going to get a penny, because somebody already owns the copyright on it. So the music that the scholarly audience of the 50s and 60s researched and studied so lovingly was not quite as romantic as they all considered it to be, because a lot of it was created by record industry people, as is today.
You know, I think there are a couple of traps that some white northern performers have fallen into when performing southern-based music. And I'm thinking, for instance, that some people seem to have almost lost their own voice when they sing. If they're singing black-based music, they get a completely different voice and try to sound like an older black man from the South. And I wonder if it was ever hard for you to find your own voice in your singing.
Well, I started out with very little, and it's growing. I remember when Bob Dylan's first record came out, I said, okay, I'm going to be a singer. If he can get away with that, I'm going to get away with this. And back in the early 60s, well, I moved south when I was 18 the first time I joined the Navy, ran away to sea, and moved to Virginia, and I've been headed south ever since. And I've been lucky to have been associated with some great masters of the industry. Some of them knew they were masters and others didn't.
Well, you spent some time trying to track down one of the musicians who you liked most, Pink Anderson. Yeah. And he's someone that probably a lot of our listeners aren't familiar with. Tell us a little bit about him, and then
sure.
I'll ask you to do a song by him.
Pink Anderson was from Spartanburg, South Carolina. He made two records in 1929. That was that. He disappeared from the recording industry. And he spent his entire career working medicine shows, little carnival deals throughout the South. He worked with Chief Thundercloud's medicine show up until about 1959. When I met him, he was retired, had a heart attack, and didn't tour at all. He was almost discovered for the folk revival. Sam Chartis recorded a few albums, but he was past his prime, and his health didn't get better, so he stayed. And people like John Hurt and Booker White and Son House came up from the Deep South to play the big festivals. And when I met Pink, he was not in great shape. But me and my friend Paul Jeremiah started to visit him. And, at one point we realized the worst thing about his health was he was starving to death down there. And he started to play again. And we took him out on tour once before he died. And it was quite a deal. Pink Anderson's music, he was a carnival performer. And his songs were white, black, and blue. You know, they were mixed up. The song that I'm going to do next, Traveling Man, has become my theme song, and it's a song that everybody in the folk field always identified with Pink Anderson, knowing that he probably didn't write it. But it's a song that goes back to minstrel shows, and it was probably a song written by a white man on Broadway. Like so many times you get a song from a New York writer on Broadway, what was Tin Pan Alley, and it filters down to the rural community, and then it's found by some folklorist as what a find. It happened throughout the history of country music and blues. I mean, Hank Williams' greatest hit, if you ask any country singer, it was probably the Lovesick Blues, and that was a song based on the yodel of Emmett Miller, who first recorded it in 1926. I mean, Hank Williams obviously learned it from that source. And Emmett Miller, who was a white man who sang in blackface in minstrel shows, toured the South in the early 1900s, say between 1915 and 1925. Every country singer, any country boy growing up would have seen a tent show with a minstrel man in there doing a parody of blues. And a lot of what we later listened to was actually a parody of the blues. And the song Lovesick Blues was written by two Russian immigrants in 1916, I believe, on Broadway.
A pretty twisted history.
Yeah.
Can you do a song for us from
sure
Pink Anderson?
Can. This is the old Traveling Man song. It came a long way. Well, I just want to tell you about a man named Boone. His home was down in Tennessee. He made his living. He was stealing chickens and anything that he could see. That pop-eyed man, they said he runs so fast that his feet never stayed in a row. When a freight train passed, didn't matter how fast, he'd always get on board. He was a traveling man, certainly was a traveling man. He was the most travelingest man that ever was in that land. Traveled everywhere, known for many miles around. But he didn't get caught and he never got whooped till the police shot him. You know that the police shot that man with a rifle? Bullet went through his head. People, they were coming from miles around just to see if that boy was dead. They telegrammed down south where his mama lived, and she was all upset with tears. She walked up and opened up the coffin's lid, but that fool had disappeared. He was a traveling man, certainly was a traveling man. He was the most travelingest man ever in that land. Traveled everywhere, known for many miles around. Didn't get caught in and never got whooped till the police shot him down. You know, this boy went down to the spring one day to get himself a pail of water. The distance that the rascal had to go was about 2 miles in a quarter. He got there and got his water and he started back, stumbled and fell down. He ran back to house, got himself another bucket, caught the water before it touched the ground. He was a traveling man. Certainly was a traveling man. He was the most travelingest man ever in that. Traveled everywhere, known for many miles around. He didn't get caught in, he never got whooped till the police shot him down. Now listen, this boy was out on a Titanic ship the day it was sinking down. He was standing out by the railing, had his head hung down. When that boy jumped overboard, everybody said he was a fool. But about 2 minutes right after that, well, he was shooting dice in Liverpool. He was a traveling man. Certainly was a traveling man. He was the most travelingest man ever in that land. Traveled everywhere, known for many miles around. But he didn't get caught in, he never got whooped until the police shot him down. Oh, Picket Roy. Caught the traveling man at last. Then they had him up to hang one day. The jurymen, they all asked that man just what did he have to say. He begged the jurymen if they would bow their heads in prayer. And then he crossed one leg and he winked one eye and he went up through the air. He was a traveling man.
Did Pink Anderson teach you that one?
Well, he didn't directly teach it to me, but I watched him play it.
Right.
He actually played it in a different key.
Was he surprised to see you tracking him down, wanting to learn his songs? If he'd only recorded 2 songs, he must have been pretty obscure in musical terms.
Oh, he went nuts when I went down there. I was sitting on his front porch. That's a long story. I don't have time to tell you the whole thing. But he came down the street, and I walked up the street towards him. I was playing the guitar on his step. I looked at him. I said, "You must be Pink Anderson." He said, "How do you know that?" I said, "Lady in the house said you went to the dry cleaners this morning. This is a dead-end street, and you're carrying clothes." He said, "You been to college?" I said, "Some." He thought I was pretty smart. I told him I've been looking for him for 36 hours. He asked me if I owed him money. I said, "No, sir, I owe you money." He says, "You do? How much?" I said, $50. He says, "Give it cheer." So I give him a $50 bill. He looked at it, snapped it twice, put it in his pocket, and then he inquired how did it come to be that I had owed him this small fortune. I told him I made a record of one of his songs. He said, "Was it a hit?" I said, "You be the judge." We became real good friends. He told me before he died, he says, "Roy," that's what he always called me. I said, "Pink." He says, "You know them old songs of mine you can almost play right?" I said, "Yeah." He says, "Well, I'm giving them to you. They're yours now. You just tell people Pink Anderson born and getting ready to die in Spartanburg, South Carolina, used to pick a guitar and sing."
It must be really something when someone who has been this obscure person on a rare record actually becomes a human being because you've met them and you see how they live and who they are and what their life has been like.
Yeah, it's pretty incredible. It's more incredible now when I think about it than when it happened. When it happened, it was just...
It just happened.
It just happened. There we were, and me and Pink Anderson. It was pretty funny.
I want to talk to you more about your music and about touring with Gary Davis. But first, we're going to take a short break. My guest is Roy Bookbinder, and he's going to play for us some more. We'll be back after this. This is Fresh Air. Let's talk a little bit about Reverend Gary Davis, who you also met. And I think this was before he had become rediscovered. He'd already been rediscovered?
Oh, he was semi-famous when I met him. He already was living in a little house in Jamaica, Queens.
Well, there must have been people standing online wanting to understudy him.
Well, there were a bunch of us that hung around. I went on the road with him in 65, I think it was. I was just out of the Navy. I was going to college on the GI Bill when I'd met him. And I went to his house and had a guitar lesson. And we seemed to hit it off. I told him I was ready to go on the road with him. And I quit school and went with him. And I traveled with him for about two to three years on and off. And there were a lot of interesting experiences. Reverend Davis was a great guitar player in many different styles. He knew he was about the best there was, and he really was.
What's some of the strumming or finger-picking style that you learned from him?
Well, Reverend Davis, he had a number of styles. He had his simple little style, like he did Candyman, and he did the Cocaine Blues, and he did Delia. And then he'd get a little more complex in his blues, like the Hesitation Blues. Nickel is a nickel and a dime is a dime. House full of children, ain't one of them mine. It was one of his other styles, and then he had an instrumental style where he imitated the piano and played ragtime pieces, which was really fascinating to the young guitar players that came around. There was a lot of interesting things going on in there. It took a lot of time for some of us to get it, some longer than others.
Most blues musicians have many stories to tell about getting ripped off while they were on the road. And I wonder if that was any worse for Gary Davis, since he was blind and it would have been that much easier for people to take advantage
of him. Well, he was taking advantage of a lot when he was singing on the streets for many years in Harlem. He'd lose guitars and what have you. First lesson Reverend Davis taught me, we got to our first rooming house out in somewhere near Chicago, and Reverend Davis was getting ready to go to bed. He says, "Now, Roy, you got to understand." He said, "We're in a strange city and a strange house here, and I don't like the house much." I said, "Well, how come?" He said, "They're not taking care of this house." I said, "Well, he's a blind man." I said, "How do you know that?" He said, "Well, the doorknob's loose. I checked it on the way in." He said, "When you go to sleep, the first thing you do," he says, "is you take out your knife." He reached in his pocket and pulled out a knife about 12 inches long. I about had a heart attack. He says, "You take your knife and you put it under your pillow." He said, "Then you get your pocketbook," and he reached down his long jaws and pulled out his little leather purse he kept all his money in. He always traveled with some money. He said, "You put that inside your pillowcase." He said, "Somebody comes for your pocketbook, you know where your knife is. You go to sleep with your hand on your knife," and he goes to sleep. Next morning, about 5:30 in the morning, Reverend Davis is screaming, "Good God Almighty, Lord, have mercy." That could mean anything. I said, "Reverend Davis, what's the matter?" I mean, I was just in dreamland. Get woken up like that. I mean, he was in his 70s, the old blind man, and he was hysterical. I said, "What's the matter?" He says, "They done got my pocketbook." I said, "Oh, Lord, have mercy." And we're crawling around the room, and he's screaming, "Who got his pocketbook? How'd somebody get in this room? He knew that door wasn't good, and didn't you hear nobody?" My heart was beating a mile a minute. I'm searching all over this room. Finally, I found his pocketbook under the bed. I says, "Reverend Davis?" He says, "Roy." That's what he always called me. I said, "I found your pocketbook. All the money's in there. Don't worry." He said, "Good God Almighty, where was my pocketbook?" I said, "You got to remember something when you go on the road." He says, "What's that?" I said, "You went to sleep real late and you were tired. And I think you put your pocketbook underneath your pillowcase and your knife inside your pillowcase. And you got it mixed up and your pocketbook fell behind your pillow onto the floor." Oh, he had a fit. "Give me that pocketbook. Where's my knife? Put all this stuff away."
Well, I hope this wasn't advice that you actually needed. Has it been dangerous for you on the road?
Oh, the road is a hazardous place. I mean, I've lived 13 years in a motor home called the bus. And there's different kinds of experiences out there. I mean, I grew up in New York City. I was lucky to escape, actually. But there's a whole new world once you cross that GW bridge. I mean, we spent a lot of time in places that when I grew up, the kind of places my mother told me not to go to. And anything can happen and usually does.
Well, I guess you've had to learn how to be not only independent, but physically take care of yourself on the road.
Well, you got to.
Can you play us a song that you learned from Reverend Gary Davis?
Yeah. Let me play a song that I wrote in the style of Reverend Gary Davis.
Great.
It was a song he always did called "I'll Be All Right Someday," and I loved that song. Always wanted to learn how to play it. Finally figured out the basics of it and came out with a little arrangement, and I decided I didn't feel comfortable singing the words that he wrote for it. It was one of these biblical epics. He had some that went on for 15 minutes, you know. And we came out with this. It's called "I'm Going Home Someday." my road is rocky and my journey's rough. If I stumble and I fall, well, I'll pick myself up, keep marching forward, and I'll drive these blues away. I've been a gambling man, I've been a cheat, I've often lost my way. I've seen the darkness, want to see the light, trying to start a brand new day. Yes, I'm going home, I'm going home, I'm going home someday. Temptation cast aside, won't take no devil ride, I'm going home someday. Wind is blowing hard, rain is coming down, and I can't keep myself warm. But I keep searching for better days and a sheltered port from the storm. I'm going home, I'm going home, I'm going home someday. Temptations cast aside, won't take no devil ride, I'm going home someday. Going to see my mother, going to see my father, going to see my baby brother too. And when I get there, I won't have to worry, I'll know just what to do. I'm going home, I'm going home, I'm going home, I say. Temptation cast aside, won't take no devil ride, I'm going home someday.
Great song.
Thank you.
You've been, speaking of another kind of home, you've been touring around for a long time, living in your motorhome, but you're trying to be based more and more in the South. You're performing a lot on a Nashville cable show. You live out of Tampa, Florida, a few months a year, I believe. And you're performing with a on a show that I suppose is trying to be, in a way, something like the Grand Ole Opry. Where do you see yourself fitting in to that?
Well, the Nashville Network is it's a showcase for country talent mostly, though they have all kinds of music. And I tried to get on there for a couple of years. We sent tapes, and all kinds of important people sent word that they were missing something. I finally got the call to do it, and it was just it was a great opportunity for me. And after the first show, the producer asked me where I'd been all these years. And I said, my stuff's been on your desk. And we're on there every 8 weeks now, at least.
Is that really different than the folk scene that you've been doing for years? For years, you've been performing folk clubs, college coffee houses.
Sure.
And you're exposed to a really different kind of listener now, I think.
Right. Well, the goal of any artist is to reach as many people as possible, and don't pigeonhole yourself into playing just to a quote, sophisticated, knowledgeable audience. I mean, the first time I played on the Nashville Now show, we got fan mail from all over the country. I got a letter from an old man in Ohio somewhere, said he first heard this mountain style of guitar playing in 1916, and he hadn't heard it for many years. He said, you just keep doing what you're doing, you're real good at it, don't let Nashville change you. And what a thrill, I tell you.
That's great. Let me ask you, when you're in a city, as you are today, where do you park your motor home?
Well, we're out of town there at the Valley Forge place, and we're lucky enough to have somebody drive us in. Though I've parked it in every major city except Manhattan.
Do you just park on the street somewhere?
Yeah, I just take 3 meters and get a lot of quarters.
Gosh. Do you lock your doors very carefully? When
I think of
you know, city life, and it just seems very vulnerable to me being parked out on the street.
I'll leave somebody in there with a shotgun.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, see, people up north laugh.
Yeah, that's what you want us to believe. Well, We're almost out of time, and there's so much that I want. Yeah.
About playing the Nashville scene and everything. It's an incredible thing to play at a state fair in rural Virginia or someplace, and have people come up to you that would have never gone to a folk festival, would have never gone to a folk club, and would never have listened to a folk show.
Do you think it's a self-limiting audience when you do the folk scene?
Definitely.
Does this mean you don't want to be in the folk scene anymore?
I'll always be part of this. I mean, it's part of the over, you know, the whole thing. You got to include everything. I mean, I feel just as comfortable being here as playing the old Gaslight Cafe on McDougal Street or playing at some little nightclub in Biloxi, Mississippi.
Roy Bookbinder has been my guest. He has a forthcoming album called Bookaroo. It will be on the Rounder record label. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.